This is a beautiful collaboration between World Vision and me, and it's a wonderful delight to be working with them in their work around the world. And there's going to be a lot of things we're learning here, a lot of things from World Vision workers from around the world, but also from all kinds of people who are at the intersection of power shifting. So this is from technology, the shifting power dynamics of what technology is doing. This is internal work, counseling. This is our economic systems shifting, even capitalism, the way that our politics work and the way that our businesses work. This is theological shifts of evangelism and what that looks like in these days. I mean, we are going to talk, folks. This season is fire. If you haven't checked out the Right Side Up season one, that's the first collaboration with World Vision and me. And it's really walking through the Beatitudes, and we're asking voices from around the world who know what it means to be blessed in that way to share with us the secrets of the kingdom and what they've been learning along the way. That still ministers to me, that season. And actually, it has become a course. So you can go to daniellestrickland.com/rightsideup, or you can go to worldvision, wvi.org/rightsideup, and you can access that season as a course with a bit of a workbook to help you through that. But this season is on power and right side up power. And I am praying that God will help us, me included, to understand how to identify my power, and then also how to use and leverage my power for his kingdom come, and to get myself out of the center of that. I'm so privileged that you're along for this journey. Check out the show notes for all the links to all the things, but we're thrilled you're here. And I pray for us all that God would help us see this disruption in this cultural season, this era, as an invitation to partner with him for God's kingdom come.
Laura and Scott, welcome to this podcast, because I want to talk about the power shift of leadership, of church leadership, of toxic cultures in church, and sort of a shift to what I would suggest might be a kingdom-centered goodness culture. And I feel like both of you have journeyed through that, and you wrote this beautiful book, a church called Tove, about goodness culture. And really, out of your own journey and probably heartbreak and experience of toxic leadership and toxic cultures, and then sort of this emergence of the biblical view. So I really wanted to talk to you about that shift in culture and in church culture, and your thoughts and background and why you wrote that book. And like, there's a whole lot of questions, but why don't we just begin by either of you, both of you, telling a little bit about how you got to that book, how you got to write that book.
Sure. Well, I can start. So first of all, thank you for having us. It's really an honor to be with you. I've enjoyed your leadership over the years, Danielle. And I actually heard you speak at Willow Creek years ago, and have followed you since then. I really respect you. So our journey is an unlikely one. When the Willow Creek story broke, for those of us here in Chicago, my father and I used to attend a church called Willow Creek. It's a mega church here in Chicago. And at the time, Bill Hybels was the pastor. And in March 2018, a story broke about him in the Chicago Tribune. And it was about allegations, sexual harassment allegations made by multiple women. So I started reading the article out loud, and immediately felt, oh no, like we recognized the name of the women. Mm-hmm. And long story short, we knew them to be truthful. They weren't women that would just make up a story to collude to take down Bill Hybels, as the church was saying. Mm-hmm. So it launched a whole series of conversations in our family behind the scenes, where my dad would explain to us privately how Willow Creek was actually misusing scripture, and they were abusing their power and twisting the narrative, like telling little pieces of the truth, but not the whole truth. And so I encouraged him, and he is here. He would probably say I pestered him.
That's the right word. He's a pest.
To write, because I felt like a larger audience needed to hear from a theologian who could say how scripture should have been used and the character of leadership that we should be looking for and how Jesus cared so much for the wounded. Mm-hmm. And that's really how the journey began, is that I was a pest and convinced my dad to write.
Well, I mean, one of the things here is when you're an outsider, and I mean, we could be Willow Creek members and we weren't, but we could be members and not know what's going on. Mm-hmm. So if you're an outsider, it's very difficult. You know, I'm a public figure. I'm a writer. I'm a professor. I'm not going to go out and start talking about something that I don't know something about. Mm-hmm. So it was difficult to find information. So it took me a while to find a way to talk about this topic at the church of power abuse, mm-hmm. that led to sexual abuse. In a way that was accurate of what had happened, at the same time that I could say something from the Bible, from theology, that could help all of us in understanding what took place and what we can do so it doesn't happen again. And so it took a while, a few months for me to go through all these conversations, to answer questions. And I had lots of students. Danielle, I had a lot of students asking me the question, you know, this kind of question, I'll never forget it. What can I do now so that I don't become a leader like that later? Mm. That's a good question.
That's a good question.
Mm. And power is a huge issue. I mean, pastors have power. They have sometimes unbridled power, and it's connected to God. And that just gives them more power. And yeah. We're in a very serious issue in the church. I'll include North America, not just
Western,
the United States.
Maybe Western culture, right? That is set up. Yeah, interesting.
But I mean, Africa has this as well.
Yes,
I know they do. Korea has this. South Korea has. So it's endemic to authority figures who have religious power to protect their power. And at times to abuse their power. Mm. And that's what we wanted to address.
You know, it's interesting. The book came out in October 2020, and we got a stream of letters consistently from readers. We were getting them weekly, and we wrote mostly about sexual abuse, but the letters we get are mostly power abuse. Mm-hmm. And the details differ, but the overall theme is largely the same, that there is a religious leader and he or she misused power in a Christian organization. And then the wounds are just excruciating, of lives that are destroyed.
Yeah, I feel like that your family just kind of untangling the story. Like, I think it's really an interesting, I'm glad you started with that, Laura, because I feel like you're like, wait a minute, like the easiest narrative to go to, which is like the dominant narrative, is it's an attack. The church, you know, protects the leader because everything's been structured and the growth of the church has been centered on the leader. You know, whoever this Herculean leader is, it could be anybody. Bill Hybels is for sure a Herculean leader in his day and his culture, right? Willow Creek, I think, was like the biggest, if not the second, third biggest megachurch in America. So, and then of course that leadership, that conference that went all around the world. So you have this like larger than life, Herculean, better than every average human, you know, like this construct that the church is built around, so that when that leader's exposed, the whole church is exposed, you know, like, so there's this like protective mechanism that just kind of folds in. And I think this is fascinating, like this is a fascinating sort of way that we design church, which in the end creates leaders that are literally the opposite of Christ-likeness. Right? Literally the opposite. I mean, not transparent, not open. So, but what happens is because the narrative's so strong and the church is so like, you know, fronting this narrative for its own survival, you have this like illusion. So you're so confused. So like, even I'm thinking about your family sitting around the dinner table, reading these articles out loud, going like, what? And then the church narrative is this narrative that like, it sounds fine. And then is like defensive. This is an attack. Now we're the victims, poor Bill Hybels, right? Like, so the people with all the power are the ones who are victimized. And then the people who are victims are actually further, you know, pushed aside as these villains. And then you're going, wait a minute, this doesn't add up, right? Mm-hmm. This doesn't add up. And you have the advantage of knowing the people, knowing these women as credible, Christ-like people who, like, what do they have to gain in this situation? So I think about that construct repeating itself, you know, and Scott, like you said, like, you could be a member of Willow and not know personally any of these characters or any of these women. And so you would just believe this grand narrative. I mean, you would just, you know, I mean, why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you? It's like, this is what you've been taught to believe. This is the pattern that you've been taught to fall into. So I think about that, just that picture of your family sort of going, wait a minute. And then that is this like micro of this macro power shift, I think, where everybody now is like, wait a minute, like, something doesn't add up. And of course, you know, Hybels is just one example. The real damning reality of this power structure is it's so prevalent. You know, I wish it was.
You know, the stories, people in a church, you want, you know, if you're a pastor, I mean, you're a public speaker. You want people to believe you, to trust you.
Yeah.
And when you are a pastor who led people to Christ, who baptized them, and who've said the right thing at the right time to transform people's lives, people are inclined to believe you.
Right.
And to trust you to mediate the goodness of God, the grace of God, the truth of God, Jesus, to them. And this is what happens, is that they can... Leaders, when they are caught in a scandal or when they're accused and there's allegations that have come forward, are going to be able to use, let's say, their data bank or their bankroll of trust in ways that can suppress and silence women or those who have brought forward allegations, and do so in a way that often wins. And that's been the narrative. But with social media today, there has become a capacity for a group of people to speak up and to gain an audience. And this is challenging the powers. And we hope that it can transform leaders' perception of power, the power they have, and get them to use that power more redemptively rather than, let's say, in a toxic manner. So that's, you know, when you say those, some of those things, that's what came to mind for me. It's a serious time for us to think about how power is going to shift. But Danielle, Laura and I both hear these stories that churches are aware of this, and they are requiring non-disclosure agreements for people to get hired, that you cannot speak publicly about our church on Twitter, Instagram, I don't even know all the things, Facebook, whatever, all these different social media, you can't use these in a negative way about our church, or we will immediately fire you, you'll lose your, you know, whatever. So that's doubling down.
Would you think that's a subtle sign that that might not be a job you want?
Yeah, it would be. I mean, but it might be your dream job,
right?
To get to work at this church or this Christian organization.
Think because of this, the narrative, and also because of the truth, there are really amazing, and this is one thing that we should probably say is, like, I know amazing churches. I know beautiful leaders. I know godly servant, Christ-like men, or else I still wouldn't be doing what I do. You know what I mean? Like, I do sometimes lose a little hope, but I'm not hopeless because I know examples of really good leaders. So this doesn't have to be the narrative. This doesn't have to be the practice. And I guess that's what I think is so hopeful about your book is, one, it's honest. So I think that's, you know, anywhere where we have to be dishonest or less than fully honest is probably like a good check on power. That's probably not a good use of power, right? Jesus is light and calls things into the light. If you can't call things into the light, you're probably like not using your power well, or there's a power thing going on that's negative. But then what I love about your book is then you're like, okay, so that's the problem, this power. And we'll talk a little bit more about that probably. But then the shift that I'm interested in is like this culture of Tov. So what is the answer then? What is it? How is it? And I love that question you brought up, Scott, about your students saying, how do I not become that? Yeah. I love that because I actually, I think I was 19 years old and I served with an incredibly gifted, charismatic leader who was a terrible human being.
Oh.
And I mean, I could see at 19, I remember going, oh, wow. Like the gifts, you know, the incredible gifts and the way that he was able to do things that other people couldn't do. But then the way he treated his wife and the way he was toxic with his kids and the way he demeaned people and diminished people. I was just like, is this leadership? You know, is this leadership? And then thankfully, I ran into another woman leader, retired leader, who was culture of Tov. She was full of authority, full of power, and was good to the core. And I realized as an early age, oh, I don't have to be that. I could be this instead.
Good for you.
And I'm so glad, because I think I was otherwise, I would have been like, oh, I guess I have to do the best I can within this idea of being a jerk, but like a good leader. So that honesty, I think, is really good. Talk to me more about like, how can we bring these things into the light? How can people bring this into the light? And then how do we shift this power? Like, I'm tired of agreeing with this idea that this is how church is and this is how we protect people and like non-disclosure agreements are normal and like it's complicated, Danielle, you know, like all of those things.
Yeah.
To like, one, how do we get more honest? How do we get honest in a godly way and then move towards a culture of Tov? How do we shift this power in a positive way?
Yeah. Well, what we did is what we studied traits of toxic churches and organizations, and some traits definitely rose to the surface. So what we tried to do in order to flip the power, as you describe, is we countered each of those toxic traits with a goodness alternative. So not that we have all the answers, but we do believe that what we call the circle of Tov can offer a radical culture shift if leaders strive to nurture those habits of goodness in their congregations. So each of them could be like hour-long conversations. I can list them really quickly. And then Deb, if you want to jump in, but we talked about resisting a narcissist culture by nurturing empathy. We have to resist a fear culture by nurturing grace. We believe it's important to put people first. We've seen over and over again with some of these power institutions that we call it institution creep, where they are inclined to protect the institution rather than caring for the people, telling the truth instead of resisting false narratives, nurturing justice and resisting loyalty. We saw this one a lot in power plays where people were loyal to the leader or the inner core at all costs rather than being even willing to consider the truth. Right. The last two are nurturing service, resisting a celebrity culture, and resisting, my dad, you've been harping on this one for years, resisting the leader culture. And I learned a lot from my dad about what Jesus really had to say about leadership.
And then your last one, oh, this is the nurturing Christ-likeness.
Christ-likeness.
Yeah, that's that. And you say that in your book, Scott, about like where meritocracy began to like dominate sort of pastoral effectiveness over Christ-likeness.
And there, you know, the guy who wrote about this endlessly, I think he griped about it for 40 years, Eugene Peterson. He saw the model of a pastor shift from someone who cared for people pastorally in a local community and wasn't a celebrity pastor or preacher, cared for people in a local community, shift to entrepreneurs and mega churches so that they became celebrities and stars and they ceased being pastors. And, you know, you've asked about how we can help shift, you know, outlining that instead of being narcissistic, we should be empathy. Doesn't happen because you preach a sermon on this. I mean, it could be a really good sermon and you could do it for 4 weeks and you can continue to talk about, and it still isn't going to shift it.
It could have a good graphic.
So Laura and I have worked on another book because we've been asked this question so many times of how can we change from a toxic culture to a total culture? Yeah. What's going on? One of the big things is people have to understand a church culture, but one of the big issues is how long it takes to build a culture. The cultures that are in our churches today didn't start yesterday. They started generations back and they've built over time, and they are a mixture of culture and society and philosophy and charismatic personalities and history and all that. And I had a student 2 years ago, I believe, who had a PhD, and he was, I don't know, auditing a class or something. And he had a PhD in organizational transformation. And I was talking about Tove and transforming a culture. And he said, you know, he said, the standard word is to change a culture takes 7 years of people who intend to change the culture.
Wow.
And that, you know, that probably means it's going to be more than 7 years, because there aren't going to be, not everybody's going to be on board.
Right. Right.
And what we believe is we need to recognize the things that are driving our culture. Like sometimes it's ambition, greed, competition, all those sorts of works of the flesh. And other side, you know, there's the fruit of the spirit, kindness, joy, etc. And we think we have to work hard to discern what is actually driving our culture. And the principal idea is that we need to have people of high character, what we call Tove character, who can help others become more Tove. So if you get 50 people in a room and 40 of them are Tove things are going to happen, unless you got a really dysfunctional person who can take over. If you have 50 people and 25 of them are toxic, you're going to have a hard time creating a good culture.
Right.
And so we believe character is most important, is that an individual character that is Tove, who works on being a person of Tove and understanding herself or himself and develops character, can become a leading force as more and more people begin to focus on character. And then we can become examples. We can become people who look like the image that we're trying to create for the church. I talked to a pastor this week, or not this week, recently, who told me he was successfully transforming his church culture from what he called a gospel culture to a kingdom culture. And I went, oh no, this language isn't working for me. But he meant, you know, that we're going to have an evangelistic sermon every Sunday.
Yeah.
And that's what we're really focused on, is getting how many people we can get saved and how big our church can be.
Right.
And what he meant by kingdom is he wanted saved people to become agents of justice and compassion in the community during the week.
Right.
So they studied the Bible, the Gospels, for 2 years or a year, no, a year, among the leaders every other week.
Yeah.
And they went through all four Gospels.
Yeah.
And by the end of that time, people were convinced that Jesus was a person who reached out with it to people in need. Mm. And then he, unknown to everybody in the church, during that year when everybody was studying the Bible, he spent a year every week in a homeless kitchen working with homeless people. Mm-hmm. So that he would know what this is actually like. He wasn't going to ask people to do something that he hadn't done. Mm-hmm. So he worked on character and he worked on being an example. And it took 5 years of working with different groups in the church for his church to become focused on moving from being saved at church every Sunday for a great evangelistic sermon to becoming saved people working in the community. And, you know, these are some of the things. This isn't going to happen because you preach some series is the point we're making. It's going to take a lot of work and a lot of introspection of yourself and of our group and honesty and listening to one another and building coalitions. Oh, we could talk for a long time about that.
You know, it is funny, but in my own experience, the people that I think have that character that exude, and actually, I think this is, I'm glad you brought this up, that when you do have a culture of deep goodness, it is contagious. Like people do want to live that way. Like being like Christ is actually a beautiful thing in the world. Like, and people are like, I like that. Like I actually like that. So I think that's really good news. Like you're not just up against, you know, bad news the whole time. You actually, Jesus was a compelling figure. People followed him, gave everything for him, died for him. You know what I mean? Like there is this beautiful attractiveness of Christ. But the other thing I really found out in my life, and I'm glad that you talked about that serving piece, like just, I think that serving or walking even with the poor or people who are disfranchised or people who are vulnerable or marginalized by the rest of the world, just being in that space, I feel like right sizes you in all of these tove areas. So it's just a really interesting, like, you know, it you're no longer, like, I remember speaking in a stadium to a youth conference in a town I was at. And then I got in my car and drove down to my inner city church. And there was a guy outside furious because I wasn't on time to put the coffee on. And I was like, do you know who I am? You know, like, and he's like, yeah, you're the one who puts the coffee on, you know, like,
that's good.
And
that's
I was
good.
Like, yeah, you nailed it. Like, I really am the one who puts the coffee. So I was like, okay, right. And it was like, literally like just in one afternoon, I was like, right. Okay, good. Like, yes, this is, I've got to come back down to earth and like part of like, this is real life. I'm a real person. I'm with real people like this. Cause there's this weird thing that happens on stages and like when you become larger than life, that if you're not intentionally right sizing yourself, this is as a leader, this isn't necessarily as a culture, but I feel like it could be a remedy if you just made mandatory for every leader to hang out with people who could not care less about Christian culture, but who just need help or coffee or a listening hand or something like that. I feel like it would do so much. And I think you see this in the life of Jesus so well.
This is, you know, I like your expression, right sizing, but here's something else. I totally agree with this. We have a little bit about this about service.
Yeah.
I also believe that the leaders, let's say the celebrities who are doing these things, should not be able to talk about it from the platform or to anybody else in public setting.
Right.
In other words, okay, if I go serve the homeless and then I can give an amazing illustration.
Yeah.
About it on Sunday.
Yeah.
Then I'm going to start doing that so I can come up with more stories for my sermons. And then I'm no longer serving. But if you serve in a way that right sizes you, a great expression.
Yeah.
And you can't talk about it.
Yes.
Except to your spouse.
Right.
Or your close people, whatever.
Right. It's a private service. Right.
That's right. Then you're going to be humiliated by it in a sense. You're going to be brought to reality.
Yes.
So, that's a wonderful expression, right sizing. I like it. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I'm going to steal it.
That, you know, this is why more women should also be leaders, because kids, mothers have a way of being right sized on a daily basis.
I was going to say, every time I walk into my classroom, I'm right sized.
Right.
5-year-olds telling me what to do.
Right. That's beautiful. What are the best ways to nurture empathy? Like, and you talk about resisting a narcissist culture. So on one level, I relate to the person on the stage because I do a lot of stages. But then on another level, I think toxic culture is not just about one leader. It's about a whole culture built around one leader.
Yeah.
And I would say that everybody wants, there is something about the cultural norm narrative, the desire of a dominant culture to want the one leader to be exceptional. And so we build cultures around that. So we want to blame. I often want to blame the leader. It's the easier thing to do, but I actually recognize the leader's just playing a part of something that a whole culture has created. So how does a culture create empathy? First of all, how does a leader do it? It's by example, but how do we as a people, a gathered people, start working towards changing our culture, our desire? Like if I'm just a person that's part of a leadership team, how do I nurture a culture of Tov in this culture, besides just that one leader's responsibility?
Yeah. You want me to say something? Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I will. And then you can go. I think you have to know who the marginalized groups are within your sphere of influence and make that known, make their needs more visible within your leadership team and within your congregation, and then empower people to use those gifts to meet the needs that are in your congregation, in your sphere of influence.
You know, Danielle, power and success and being on a platform distorts the brain. Is that the more self-centered your performances become because of the glory that you get from it, there are studies on this, and we relate this in the book, is your brain becomes less and less capable of empathizing with people who are in need.
Wow.
So to flip that, you have to practice humility, or you have to practice serving in a way that degrades your glory. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that there need to be regular actions of empathy. You know, some of the greatest leaders in the history of the church are called the Cappadocians. And they are, we're talking 3rd and 4th century, Turkey, central Turkey, Basil the Great, Gregory of Nyssa, his sister Macrina, Gregory of Nazianzus. And these people not only were brilliant theologians and great preachers, but they built an entire, they really started hospitals. They built an entire village that was concerned with taking care of the poor. Mm-hmm. And this gave them such an amazing balance in their theology that it showed up in all ways. And I think that's one of the great things that leaders can do to develop empathy. If they find themselves unempathic, then they need to practice spending time on a regular basis with those who are in need. And it will help rewire their brain in the direction of empathy. You know, if you can fire people and it doesn't bother you, if you know, and distort their lives and ruin their economy and their family and their future and their hopes, and it doesn't bother you, if you can, you know, really, well, I mean, if you can do those sorts of things, you have the marks of narcissism.
Yeah.
And almost all people who are on platforms, Chuck DeGroat wrote about this, pastors and professors, he said to me one day, are all on the spectrum of narcissism.
Right.
And so we're all possibly being intoxicated and numbed about our own narcissisms. And if we become aware of that, just that this is a problem for all of us, then we can begin to practice checking it. And that's what I think that we can do to work with empathy. Just practice seeing people in need and responding properly.
I think that's beautiful, and a beautiful way to at least begin. I also wonder, like I try to bring friends with me on journeys who are real and who I'm real with. So there isn't this sort of like, you know, so I think one of the dangers of creating toxic cultures is to surround yourself with people who are constantly telling you, feeding you this myth. Like you are amazing.
Perfect.
Like you
That's
are
exactly
different from
right.
everyone. You are incredible. I remember being on this trip with a friend of mine, and the guy was driving us to an event, and he turned to my friend and said, "So you'll get her bag." And I remember my friend said to him, "Oh no, she has arms. She can carry her own bag." And so now I'm like, literally, that's what I say all the time. I have arms. I even have legs. I can walk. We can park. We can walk in together. Like, it's like these work, you know, I'm like fully capable. So, I mean, not to like diminish people who want to serve other people. It's not that, but it literally is that who can you get in your life who will just tell you the truth and who you can just be yourself with? Because I think that's you know, I meet so many leaders who, again, they're narcissists, the narcissism of this culture, but also they're lonely. It's like a prison. They think it's success, but it actually turns out to be a prison because they're unknown. And to be unknown is to be unloved, right? And then just so you see this like cycle that's actually just in the end diminishing their humanity. So I wonder about furiously, and maybe that's nurturing grace or putting people for, I don't know, but I wonder about if people had authentic relationships in their life that were honest and real, if that might be a remedy. Not just people who were placed around you to prop up and to keep this myth alive, you know?
And we did find that over and over again, is that it wasn't just the fault of a narcissistic leader. It was an entire system that propped it up and right. allowed it to continue and happen. So people will say, how did this happen? Did nobody see it? Did nobody know? Oh, typically there were people that knew, but they felt loyal to the leader, or they too felt important and close to the power and allowed it to continue.
Yeah.
I like what Plutarch, you said about being authentic.
Yeah, that is good. Plutarch, in the first and second century, wrote this essay called, it's a book, How to Tell a Flatterer from a Friend. And it's all about leaders, it's actually kings and emperors, etc.
Right.
And he has brilliant analysis of what a flatterer is. And how seductive it is to surround yourself with yes people. And, you know, the word I like is sycophants, who are just going to suck up to you and tell you whatever you want to hear.
Yeah.
And he says that a genuine leader in that sense needs friends, not flatterers, because friends have what's called frankness. And we translate this in the New Testament with the word boldness. But a frank person is able to say, that was not a very good sermon. You did not prepare very well.
Right.
And that's not mean. It's telling the truth.
Right.
But, you know, this is, that's what a true friend is.
Yes.
A true friend is not going to tell you what you want to hear all the time.
Right.
A true friend will tell you the right thing at the right time. And sometimes it'll be a little painful.
It goes back to Tov character for me. It takes a Tov character to be willing to hear the truth. And sometimes the hardest truth is to hear about yourself.
Yeah.
You know, as you guys were explaining a Tov culture, you know, and even that cycle of creating Tov culture, I was actually thinking how difficult it is. I was thinking about this, like, so you have a church that an accusation's come and the church just goes into defense mode and protect mode and like demon mode. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, wow, isn't that like the inside of me?
Yeah.
Like I do the same thing. Like my ego goes into full throttle, right? Like an accusation comes against me and my ego is like, what, how dare you? You know? And then like all my defenses come out and then I rally the troops and try to defend. And I just think, isn't that fast? So unless we're, and I guess this is where that culture takes 7 years to nourish. But I wonder how long it takes within us, you know, to not be afraid of the truth, to be honest and authentic, to say, yes, please tell me, because I know this truth could set me free to be truly authentically good instead of pretending to be great.
Well, there are some areas we're more vulnerable to be corrected than other areas. The deeper it is to our identity and the more we risk, let's say, our career, our vocation, our reputation, we're going to be more protective. And that's what's going on with most of these pastors. When they go into the lie mode and false narrative mode, they realize that their entire career, their entire reputation is up for grabs and it could be destroyed. And their family could be ruined.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, their wife.
Their legacy, their...
Yeah, everything. Yeah. So you can see why they would protect. This is the story that Laura and I have been walking with for 3 years.
Yeah.
And I get up in the morning dreading what kind of story we might hear next. sometimes.
We have a section in our new book. It came out of a conversation that I had with a very Tove person, Steve Carter, you may know him. And it was about, it's all about how discerning culture starts with knowing yourself and being honest with the truth about yourself. And if you're not willing or able to look at who you are, I'm thinking some of the celebrity, you know, pastors that we've seen, I don't know the word, fall in recent years, you know, I don't think they were really willing to own the truth about themselves. And sometimes that's the hardest work of all.
Well,
that's good that Steve says that. That's a good observation.
It comes out of his own probably, like journey of reckoning with. And I think back to those students saying, like, how do I not be that? Because I like, so this is one thing is like, there is a whistleblowing season upon us. And that's how we know the power is shifting. There's a toppling. And Scott, you said this early on in this interview, is the social media created an opportunity for voices to be heard that had been suppressed. Very similar to Reformation, right? Was it like other priests didn't try to reform the church? It was just, they were all shut down until the printing press. And, you know, you print enough copies and those, you know, the church can't take it back. And then, you know, the Pandora's box is open. So I feel like that's the season upon us, which is why we're in the shift, is like these voices are finally being heard. But what do you think about if you do know that you're in a toxic culture and you've got all the spidey senses going on, you look at the circle of Tove and realize, wow, narcissism, fear, you know, institution first, you know, you're in a culture where it's like the very first question. I always say this, if your first question is what's the best decision for our church or what's the best decision for this organization, you're in a deeply flawed, toxic culture. And false narratives, you know, you're listening to the narrative or like the mission statement and you're like, ugh, inside going like, ugh, that's not right. Or, you know, everyone's loyal regardless. And a loyalty is a badge of acceptance in the church or organization even. What do you recommend? Do you just do you just leave? Do you exit? Do you tweet? Do you blow a whistle? Do you write privately to the elders board? Like, what is how do we join God in the power shifting? Because I do think there is a prophetic whistleblowing sort of anointing out there right now. Even Steve Carter, you know, just going like, I can't do that. I can't preach on the stage and leaving town, writing a blog saying like, there's not a transparent, like there's no transparency here. There's bad decisions being made. I can't pretend it's
well,
okay
powerful.
Anymore. You know, that's a moment, right? A whistleblowing prophetic moment.
Yeah.
Do we need that? Is that like, do we need more of that? Like, are we at risk of tiring of that? Like, are we afraid of that? Like, I just feel like, when do we just not stop that until we get to the end of toxic culture? What role is that? And how do we play it?
This has been the most common question that people have asked us in the last 2 years is, what do? We see these toxic red flags. What do I do? How do I make it Tove? And Dad, you can answer it better than I, but one thing that we've learned is the farther you are from power, the harder it is to affect any change. You really have to be a power maker, decision maker to implement some of the changes that would be needed.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I've had pastors tell me this. I've said, okay, what if someone in your church, you know, an ordinary person recognizes that there's toxicity, what can happen? And one pastor said to me, you know, if you're not happy and you're a marginal person in the church, in a sense, okay, there is such a thing.
Yeah.
Probably go to a different church because it's not going to happen.
Right.
And what Laura said is what we have learned is you have to be near the power to effect change in your church. Mm-hmm. We have a whole chapter on this in our next book because we're asked it so much, but it's sort of a microcosm of the big picture of how to transform a culture. And we have often used the expression that you need to get yourself into a pocket of Tove. Of other people who are thinking like you, you know, that you're not a nuisance, you're not being, you know, an obstructionist. You're just practicing Tove, and picking the moment when you think you have an opportunity to say something that could make a difference. Mm-hmm. Find some people in power that will listen to you, have very low expectations. Your first one is they'll at least meet with me and I get to tell them what's going on.
Right.
But don't think that just because you got to have a meeting with a third level pastor at a mega church, right, that person's going to go in and change. And when you come back Sunday, it's going to all be different. That's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So develop realistic expectations of what can happen. I also believe, Laura and I talked about this, and if she doesn't agree with me, she would just have to be wrong on this one. And then, set like a time schedule for yourself. How long am I willing to put up with this nonsense that I see? And say, I'm going to give it 6 months. I'm going to give it a year. If it doesn't happen, I'm not going to put up with it anymore. And I think people have to decide when they leave, whether they want to leave loud. You know, that's the new expression. Go on Twitter and see if you can rise up. There's a woman that I had a long conversation with last week. I can't remember what day it is, but I think it was last week. And she's trying to get a denomination to develop an abuse policy. And she's a lone voice in a fairly large denomination, and it's not getting any traction. But I told her, just keep up for a while, because it might hit the right person at the right time in a month. And then all of a sudden, it's going to get traction.
Right.
So you might want to leave that way. I think you should try to follow the procedures in the church as much as possible. You know, don't stand up on Sunday morning in the service and start screaming at the pastor. That's just going to make it worse for your case. But try to do the right thing. Try to follow the policies of the church and proper methods of confronting people. But you're going to have to kind of figure out whether you have a chance. And if you don't, move on. It's sad, but that's what, I know many people.
Yeah. I like that idea of setting a timeline and like an actionable, like I'm going to do these things for this long. And then if there isn't any change so that I like that idea because a lot of the despair and hopelessness and actually harm that can set into people in their own faith journey is this, like, if nothing will ever change. So like this getting stuck in this culture that's toxic and then not having any way out.
Yeah.
So I like that idea. I like that. I think that's really practical, Scott. Thanks for sharing that. Just a timeline and some actions that you can take. What power do you have? What voices might listen? And to do what you can is a beginning.
Yeah.
If you're experiencing, so I had a woman, a whistleblower in a church that I'm a part of these days, because we're going to do this one more time. Gosh, I'm so tired of, I've been calling it cleaning up men's messes in church leadership for so many years. I had a weak moment on Twitter and I did say, I'm just giving permission to all male church leaders to take 5 years off and get some counseling. And we'll take it for a while. And then when you're ready, maybe we'll consider bringing you back. You know,
Aristophanes, the Lysistrata is all about this. Yeah,
I did erase it because it was a little bad timed. But anyway, I... but I do, you know, for her to get to the place where she was even willing to speak up, it took her a year and a half, almost 2 years of counseling. Just, you know, just care, just sheer care. And like, it was probably about a year or more into that where she could actually see clearly what had happened. And I think I'm not sure even about like this goodness culture, like, so you might be a spectator in it, but I also think that I wonder if the research might suggest that just getting healthy, like, so getting out of toxic culture and emphasizing care, like, and honesty and help and just getting healthy and then maybe trying to speak to culture. Cause I feel like sometimes when you're in the midst of the culture, you're actually, that toxic thing has gotten in you too. Mm-hmm. So you're like, you're speaking out, but you're doing it in a toxic way and you're hurting yourself and you're hurting other people. And like, it's all, I wonder maybe about also setting a timeline for change and then actually caring for yourself. Like, what needs to heal in order for you to actually even change culture in a positive way?
You know, something you said really struck me. Sometimes you can't see it when you're in it. That was my experience, is that I felt like something wasn't right. And there were maybe some red flags along the way. And I remember just sitting in the Willow Creek Auditorium and just feeling a little bit depressed, but not able to really pinpoint it. And it took going to a different church where I had gotten caught up in the celebrity culture of Willow, and going to a little Anglican fellowship where there was no production. There's no screens, there's no stage, there's no clapping for anybody because there's no stage for anybody to be on for me to see the unhealthiness of it. Mm-hmm. So I've told people that sometimes is like, sometimes you don't see it when you're in it. Sometimes it takes getting out to recognize it and be able to speak to it.
And Diane Langberg, I'm sure you know who she is. Diane Langberg, often says that you need to be healed in order to be able to confront. You've got to be in a pretty good position yourself to be able to have the courage to come forward and say some of these difficult things. I think that is so important. Mm-hmm. And if you're really wounded and still deeply wounded, to come forward is probably just going to deepen your wound rather than do any good. Mm-hmm. Maybe you made a point, but by and large, you're going to come away a lot more wounded. So I think you're right about healing. I think that's very important in the process. And so many people are wounded, and it's going to take them a good while to heal from the spiritual abuse that they've experienced.
January is Spiritual Abuse Awareness Month. It's happening now as we're recording. And mm-hmm. I've been paying attention to stories of survivors, and many of them did not even know that abuse was happening until they got out, or until somebody shared their story and somebody said, well, this isn't right. This is abusive.
Yes.
It's hard to see when it's happening.
Do you guys think that we're at the end of the celebrity church? Do you feel the institution tumbling?
As long as we've got the Southern Baptists, we're going to have some celebrity churches.
Do you think the Southern Baptists are feeling the shake? I had Kyle Howard on a podcast recently. And I just was like, whoa, I feel like such a pansy compared to this guy. But he was just like, get out, you're complicit. Like, you're a like, he was just, I was like,
Well, Danielle, I think we can't look at the church that way.
Right.
There are different churches in different locations and different parts of this issue.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of mega churches with Tov cultures. I mean, a megachurch doesn't equate to toxicity. There's a tendency, there's a greater tendency there, and it takes a bigger ego to be in that kind of church. But I don't think, I would just say that we're on a spectrum, but what we are on the precipice of is a realization that the church needs to clean its act up. I don't know of anybody who thinks the church is in a good condition in the United States.
Right.
I mean, maybe you're in a southern town that is filled with really wonderful born-again Southern Baptists and Methodists and Churches of Christ people. And it's really a good town. I mean, there are places like that. But by and large, the witness of the church has been so harmed that many of us are saying, we need to rethink how we're doing things. Yeah. So I think we're at the end of something and in the transition towards something, but it will be a spectrum of change. It won't happen all at once.
Right.
It'll take a generation of different leaders saying we need to do things different.
I caught such a different vision of the church a few summers ago when we vacationed in England. Yeah. And it was it was such a contrast to American churches in England. We were at C.S. Lewis's church in outside of Oxford. And I was like, this is such a different vision of the church. It's a parish church, and all the people in the community would go to their church, and they would be cared for by their church, and they would be cared for by the pastor, and they were buried in the cemetery right outside that church. And it didn't matter if the pastor was great or if the pastor was bad, that was the church in the neighborhood, and that's right. Where you went. And it was so startling. I liked that vision. It's so different from, you know, we drive 30 minutes to.
Right. And it's rational, celebrity based. Yeah. Right. Our church is better.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's good.
Wow. I wonder, I think it comes all the way back a full circle to that opening question that you got asked by your students is like, we don't know exactly. It could look like a whole bunch of different forms, but we just know we don't want to end up in this toxic place anymore.
Yeah.
That's and right. So if that's, you know, if it looks like a home church or a backyard community or a parish model or like an old fashioned church with no platform or like some, you know, smoke machines, that might matter a lot less than this culture that we could do, this culture of Tov, this goodness, that this Christ-likeness that God calls us to. I'm so grateful to you both for writing this book. And the next one, what's it going to be? What's it going to be this next one? And when's it coming out?
Well, they didn't like our first title, A Church Called Tove, but my dad convinced them to use it. So the second title is still up for grabs. We'll see what it's called. What's it currently called, Dad?
Well, I think we have on the manuscript Tove Unleashed.
Oh, nice. Good. Yeah.
They don't really want to use Tove again. They said They said we don't put Hebrew titles. We don't put Hebrew words in titles of books.
Nice.
But it's at the publisher. I mean, we gave it to them, I think, three or four weeks ago.
Well, and Scott, you're like, okay, look, this is book number 82. So like, you might want to listen to me. And Laura, you're like, this is book number 3. So like, this isn't our first rodeo.
Yeah.
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 No, I just laugh at my dad. The first funny story about the title, A Church Called Tove, they came back and said, we think it sounds too much like A Man Called Ove. You know,
I'm just reading that. I'm reading that right now.
Oh, and I love that book. And my dad, before I knew, I was like, my dad doesn't read novels. I was like, I tried to get back to the computer before he saw the email, and he had already written, nobody's ever heard of that book. It'll be fun. It's a best-selling novel.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
And the publisher was like, okay.
But here's the thing. We said, you just start using this word a little bit in your office, see what happens. And they, before long, they all loved it. They all love it. Yeah. And my students use the word Tov all the time.
Right, so, right. We're bringing back. We're bringing back the Hebrew original, for goodness sake. We're bringing it back. Well, thank you for writing that and for unleashing and continuing to push this culture of goodness. That is the shift, right? That goodness would actually would go forward. Scott, I just wanted to say also just thank you for your writings before. So like I accidentally in a weird way read The Blue Parakeet. And way back when, and just I recommend it to absolutely everybody on like a primer on exegesis. But just that example of women, you know, in the exegesis using women was just so powerful. I just thought, wow, I loved it because it was a book on exegesis, not a book on women. Yeah. And I think it got so much more traction. So I just loved it. It's been and even both of your boldness, your willingness to put it out there. I know that that's costly. But it's an example of Tove, you know, it's an example of Tove. So thanks for being that in the world. And
thank you for what you're doing.
Yeah, I'm going to keep trying. I'm going to keep trying. And I'm going to try to be quieter about my service, but it's hard when you need material, Scott. It's so hard.
Yeah, I know. I'm just saying is that when you start, doing it.
Yeah, you end up using using people instead of loving people. Yeah, absolutely.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, well, keep it going, guys. And I hope you recover quickly. Hope you recover quickly, Laura.
Thank you.
Your symptoms are minor. You're vaccinated. Like, are you?
I'm vaccinated and boosted. So hopefully it doesn't get me.
and it won't take long.
Yeah.
Come on. All right.
All right.
Well, thank you, Danielle.
You guys.
Good to meet you. All
right, yeah, bye-bye. You too.
Nice to meet you. Bye.
Okay, take care.
Brave Global is an organization that is near and dear to my heart. It seeks to come alongside and coach communities and churches and groups, nonprofits, in how to reach vulnerable girls before they're trafficked. It is such an incredible strategy. And there's journals, there's a new journal out, there's a book of survivor stories that's just come out called Brave in Real Life. There's so many things. There's events that you could host. There are Brave Circle support groups. There are just so many things that are on offer in order to mobilize people to help in the fight against trafficking. And there's never been a better time to get involved in this than right now. So please go to braveglobal.org, or if you're in Canada, braveglobalcanada.org, and check out all of Brave, and please join us in this fight. It is so key right now.